Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. And we move to the third case this morning, Lane v. Winters.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Not just a minute.
May it please the Court. The District Court's decision granting summary judgment to the Rushville officials on the two claims before this Court should be reversed because in granting summary judgment, the District Court improperly resolved material factual disputes in the Rushville officials' favor. When the record is reviewed properly in the residents' favor, it shows material factual disputes as to the reasonableness of the policy. As to the written correspondence claim, the state officials rely upon two interests to justify the policy: security and a claimed lack of resources to open the internal mail system to residents.
But didn't the district court on the written correspondence aspect of things really just decide in the end there is some ability to exchange written correspondence, true, at the price of a stamp through the post office, and it may not be immediate, but it's not a wholesale ban, and to implement some policy that allows notes being passed around throughout the facility would be quite burdensome.
The district court found that under the alternative means to exercise the right prong of Turner that the Postal Service was sufficient. However, in doing that, the district court held that, I believe the quote was, that the Rushville officials do not have to test their assumptions regarding the policy. And I would submit that this gets to your point, your Honor's question about whether or not opening the internal mail system would burden the facility's resources. And I would submit, Your Honor, that when enough evidence is submitted on the other side of the scale, as outlined in our brief, regarding the minimal burden that opening the internal mail system to residents would pose, that I don't think the district court could have resolved that question regarding whether it was unduly burdensome at the summary judgment stage.
But, you know, you're asking for a degree of micromanagement here. And what I'm additionally concerned about with this part of your claim is where is the link between clinical concerns and a more permissive written correspondence policy? We're looking at Turner, even though this is in some sense a therapeutic institution, not a punitive institution. But I'm not sure whether the record is there to show that clinical concerns aren't being met by what's happening.
I think in this instance, Your Honor, it's important to distinguish between the two claims. As to the written correspondence claim, at least in this court, we're not necessarily relying upon the importance of written correspondence to treatment. This is, in a very similar sense, this could be analyzed just without considering the therapeutic effects, in other words.
So in other words, because I'm wondering, if we were looking at a prison facility and this was the written correspondence policy, it's hard for me to imagine that we wouldn't find that this was enough of an outlet to satisfy whatever associational rights the prisoners retain after they're in prison. Now, again, I'm well aware these are, whatever we don't want to call them, residents as opposed to prisoners. But how can this how can the U.S. Mail, complaints to one side and jokes to one side about the U.S. Mail, how can it be seen to be so insufficient?
The reason why it's insufficient, Your Honor, is that the record shows that there's a letter in the record that shows that it took over 2 weeks to be mailed. In that situation, Your Honor, any sort of communication among residents in the interim that might be of an urgent nature is effectively denied.
And why can't they, if it's urgent, go to one of the staff members of the place and communicate the need to get the message passed along?
And the record indicates that if that request would be denied under the current policy.
They're not allowed to tell the staff, you know, I have an urgent problem, please tell somebody else?
I'm sure that they are allowed to tell them, but the record as to whether or not the request would be honored is that if it were a request to pass written communication between units, it would be denied.
Well, I was imagining
written, not
oral.
Written communication. Let's say someone has a brother in another unit and needs to get a message that a relative has died or something of that. nature.
The only record evidence regarding the particular instance that Your Honor is positing is that Mr. McAdory, who was the security director at the time, said that he might honor a request of two relatives who are housed in different units if, for instance, their father had died or something like that. That's the only evidence that he didn't say that he would. He said he might. He said more or less that any other request to speak with someone in another unit would be denied under the current policy.
Now, your evidence of the lightness of the burden, remind me again of what that is.
Sure. The mailroom clerk by the name of Wanda Pienaar was deposed, and at her deposition she stated that right now residents through the U.S. mail do not send a burdensome amount of communications to each other.
So there are very few letters, very few go to the effort of actually writing a letter to another inmate.
Exactly. So that even if, Your Honor, there was a 100-fold increase in resident-to-resident communication, there would be about 300 per year, which is less than one letter per day.
But I thought you were also willing to accept some numerical limit if the institution were worried about being overwhelmed.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Under the Turner prong, that's an alternative means that the facility could implement to accommodate their concern over lack of resources.
There is nothing in the record about a comparable institution that allows sort of intra-institution correspondence.
There is not, Your Honor, and I've searched for a case addressing this question, and to my knowledge, none exists.
Are the internal communications subject to examination?
The U.S. mail is generally not subject to examination. In other words, the record shows that when a resident wants to send a letter to another, the U.S. mail is not read as a matter of policy by facility officials.
In order to the benefit of the prisoner or the residents, they could be guaranteed if they sent it by U.S. mail, nobody else would see it.
I'm not sure that they could be guaranteed if it didn't contain anything that would cause the person, when looking at the outside of the envelope, to be concerned that it contained contraband. Then they would have.
We're talking about the fundamental differences between communications that are very private and communications that aren't.
That's one way to look at it, Your Honor. I do think that the facility.
I think that, as far as control of the institution, that's a very serious way of looking at it.
And I think from a control of the institution, the facility, as another alternative means to allow residents to communicate internally, could condition their opening the internal mail system to residents on the resident allowing someone in the facility to review it first. That would alleviate much of the security concern that the state officials rely upon, while also accommodating reasonably the rights of residents to a more efficient communication system. So, Your Honor, I think that issue cuts both ways. And on the internal mail system, I actually think it cuts in our direction a little bit more.
So since time is short, let me ask you a question about your personal interaction direct association, if you will, claim. If I'm understanding you correctly, and this is what I want you to tell me, what you want in this injunction is simply a directive that the personal interaction policy be revamped with the participation of either Dr. Jumper or whoever the clinical person is, so that clinical concerns are built into it? Is that what you see?
That is one component, Your Honor, and if I may just address the background law to explain why that's not totally what we're seeking.
Okay.
Under Youngberg, there are two requirements for a policy that affects treatment. The first is that it be made with clinical input, and that's the concern that Your Honor was just
addressing.
Because
at the moment, the record shows it has not been.
Exactly. If, however, at a trial, the district court were to find that the current amount of interaction falls below minimum professional standards, and that is what plaintiff's expert testified to in his deposition, and this is on page 287 and 288 of the separate appendix. If the district court were to make that finding, then the injunction would need to go further to make sure that the total amount of social interaction did comply with minimum professional standards.
So there would be maybe a two-step process where the state authorities would come up with a new policy with the right kind of input, and that would then be reviewed by the court to see or somehow reviewed to see if it met minimal standards?
I think the plaintiffs would look at it, and I'd have our expert look at it and make a determination as to whether or not it complies with minimum professional standards. If it does not, then we would explain that to the district court and ask that the new policy not be accepted.
Okay. I mean, I realize there is or appears to be some contested evidence, or at least you have evidence in the record, that the policy as it now stands, limiting people to these 25-person pods mm-hmm. and so on, falls below the standards that your expert testified to. Right?
That's yes, and that's on page his ultimate conclusion is on page 287, 288.
But you could almost end up with the same policy, it seems to me, if Dr. Jumper were there and the security people were there and they said, look, you know, we remember Joliet. Everything was a mess all the time, people attacking each other, doing all sorts of things. We really can't sustain a healthy clinical environment with bigger groups. Suppose they said that.
That's possible, Your Honor. If I may, I don't think the resident would support that. In fact, the evidence shows that when the facility moved from Joliet to Rushville, the clinical staff were the individuals who went to the security official, Mr. McAdory, at the time, and said, can we allow them to interact more often? That's what we allowed at Joliet. Mr. McAdory never worked at Joliet. He had no personal knowledge regarding whether there were actual security threats at the Joliet facility that were of such a magnitude that they needed correcting at Rushville.
Does the record contain evidence? I mean, the state's brief begins with sort of a lurid tale of what goes on. But does the record contain any history of the experience at Joliet?
It does not contain any record evidence of the experience at Joliet.
So either way, okay.
No, it does not. But my point, Your Honor, was that in that situation, the individuals who had worked at the Joliet facility and who have expertise in clinical issues actually expressed the concern that more interaction was appropriate, not less. I don't think at this particular stage in the case, the district court could have reviewed all of that evidence and made a determination that as a matter of law, no further clinical input was needed. Because, in fact, as Dr. Jumper testified, he did not even know the amount of clinical interaction, or I'm sorry, social interaction that residents housed in different units are allowed. And I see him in my rebuttal, if I may make just one more point. The Rushville officials regarding the written correspondence claim base much of their defense on what they call the cornerstone of the policy, which is the security policy, or the security rationale. And it's important for the court to note when reviewing that rationale that the issue here is not whether or not written communication as a whole causes a security problem. It's whether internally delivered written communication causes a further security concern that U.S. mail does not. As to that policy, the only testimony in the record is the testimony of former facility director Phillips that the internal mail system or that the U.S. mail provides a cooling-off period, a three-day delay, he called it, between sending and receipt that would make it less likely that residents would act on their impulsive tendencies. Mr. McAdory, however, was the Rule 30b-6 witness from the Department of Human Services as to what the official rationales for the policy are. Mr. McAdory never mentioned the cooling-off argument. And, in fact, when he was asked explicitly, and this is on page 209 and 210 of the separate appendix, whether or not there was any security rationale that would distinguish between internal mail and U.S. mail, he said no. So I think the contradiction in the testimony between Mr. McAdory and Mr. Phillips as to whether or not the facility...
I just asked you earlier, though, one's examined, one type of correspondence examined, the other isn't. Isn't that a difference?
They could... I don't. Maybe I misunderstood earlier, Your Honor, but I don't think that under either situation, under current facility policy, they would be any of the mail, whether sent to the U.S. mail or the internal mail, would be subject to being read. But if the facility were to open the internal mail system, they I think could reasonably condition it on allowing the internal mail to be read, which would address that concern in a way that actually lessens security concerns.
Let me. I'm confused now. Is the U.S. mail read?
No, unless from looking at the outside of the envelope, they think that there's contraband in it. And even then, they may not even read it. They may just, I think the testimony is that when they think there's contraband, the mail clerk calls the resident into the room and has the resident shake out
the bottom line is, in general terms, it's not read.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Where the internal mail system is read.
The internal mail system could be read. Because the internal mail system is not open to residents yet, I don't think there's any record as to whether it would be. But it certainly could be, and that would be a reasonable, obvious alternative to a ban on the internal mail system. I'm sorry, I have a 9/11.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the balance.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Evan Siegel on behalf of current Facility Director Terry Williams and Security Director Forrest Ashby. Your Honors.
So just to be clear, there is actually no internal mail system right now. So we're talking about the U.S. mail as it currently stands versus some hypothetical internal mail system that, if it were thought that there needed to be one, would be constructed somehow with whatever safeguards to volume, to security, et cetera, seemed appropriate.
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the association claim, if I may, and there are three independent reasons for this court to affirm the district court. First, Youngberg has no bearing in this situation. The plaintiffs read far too much into what it offers. Second, if professional clinical input is required under Youngberg, we had it here because
Your first point may be a good one. I can't see how you had it in light of Dr. Jumper's testimony, which is essentially, I didn't play any role in it. And you have other testimony from the clinical people that they were hoping for more interaction. Surely there are at least factual issues here that need further development.
No, there aren't. There are two different issues at stake. In terms of the clinical input that Your Honor mentioned, the clinical staff recommended to, I believe, former Director Phillips in around 2010 that the facility be reconfigured by the residents' participation in treatment or non-participation in treatment, other factors such as whether they're a predator or vulnerable. And they did ask, in terms of interaction, that there be more, but that was rejected.
So Jumper says he's not involved in the decisions regarding which units use YARD. He says no one on the clinical staff is involved in that decision. He says the operational needs of the facility would supersede because security and safety is the overall guiding principle. I mean, I don't see a team approach here where his voice with clinical needs is being weighed. I don't know what the outcome would be, to be honest. You know, it seems to me possible after the process the plaintiffs are looking for. It might look a lot like what you have now. I really don't know, but we haven't had that process.
Well, it's important to distinguish between two different types of input. There is no disputed issue that Dr. Jumper doesn't, and his clinical staff, don't participate on a daily basis or earlier on a planning basis on the activity schedule.
Right, the planning, but the structural basis is where his voice doesn't seem to have been heard. McAdory sees this as another prison. And, you know, it isn't a prison, actually. The Supreme Court has, you know, not just Youngberg. You've got the two Kansas cases, Hendricks and Crane. You've got Youngberg. This is a civil commitment facility.
Correct. But Dr. Jumper and his clinical colleagues were an important voice who participated in the 2010 decision to reconfigure the units according to residential characterization and whether they were participating.
That is a prior point. I mean, how many pods you have, who's in which unit, isn't really this focus, is it? I thought it was about then intermixing pods, et cetera, in a more flexible way.
You're partially correct, Your Honor. The architecture of this structure and how people live on certain wings, A and B, where there's no clinical treatment versus C and D, where there are, dictates fully who they're allowed to come into contact with on a daily basis.
And did Dr. Jumper think about the clinical implications of that rigidity?
Well, yes, he did. He said,
"Where's the evidence?"
At page SA 294 of the appendix, which is his affidavit, he explained that residential interaction is based upon the same factors that are considered when determining rooming assignments.
But that's a descriptive statement. Does he say, I recommended as the clinical director, or I recommended against this but was overridden, or does he give any indication?
Yes, I believe he does. There's two types of input, again. There's input into the reconfiguration, the macro, and that can be found at page SA 230 and SA 235 and 293 to 294. and I'm also McAdory's deposition at 26, Jumper's deposition at 69. There are two types of inputs here. There's the configuration input, the architectural, if you will, that Dr. Jumper and the clinical colleagues played a role in, which explains that interactions on a day-to-day basis is rooming assignments writ large. Secondarily, there is input from Dr. Jumper, and more accurately, his clinical colleagues, who he supervises, into the rooming assignments. So we never have people assigned to rooms together in a unit on a pod where one is in treatment and the other is not in treatment.
Right, and I guess I'm finding this a non-responsive answer, because it may be very sensible to have the units and the pods organized as they are, in treatment, not in treatment, you know, other issues, as I understand it is. But now the question is, you have a pod, so that's where people are going to go to bed at night. You know, that's where they're going to sort of be at home. But then they go out into the yard, or they do other things in the facility. And are there ways that people are allowed to intermingle so that they can learn how to be with different people? And the answer is no. The answer is Dr. Jumper doesn't say anything about input on that.
He's not involved in scheduling decisions, but there are some.
And it's more than scheduling. I think he's trying to say there are clinical implications. Well, that's why they wanted to replicate Joliet.
Well, no. The overall, I want to go back to my first point about the application of Younger. The overriding security, the overriding interest in this facility is security. That's the paramount consideration. And Youngberg aside, this court's cases recognize that not every institutional decision turns on professional judgment. There's a trio of cases that we cite, the West case, the Thielman case, and the Allison cases, and they hold that detainees may be subject to conditions that put goals such as preventing escape and the safety of others at the forefront.
Well, yes, but I mean, the quote from Youngberg is, we emphasize that courts must show deference to the judgment exercised by a qualified professional.
But in West, this court, in interpreting Youngberg, said that when security interests are at stake, and that case dealt with the shackling of a resident, the defendants had no liability even if there was some sort of secondary treatment issue.
But you're saying that this is actually just a prison, then. There's nothing but security going on here.
I'm not saying that at all.
Oh, I think
90% of our employees, some 180 people out of 210, are security employees. Security is the essential ingredient to ensure that there's going to be successful therapy. You can't have these residents running amok acting out their sexual violence on each other. You have to have a stable environment for them to benefit from the therapeutic benefits that we offer. And to avoid potential conflicts and violent confrontations, Rushville separates residents based on...
Well, I understand all that. I mean, but I guess you're saying, essentially, under Youngberg, that it's fine not to involve the therapeutic personnel in any of the decisions.
I'm not saying it. This court has said that security can be a paramount consideration apart from any clinical issue, because the one is an essential ingredient of the other. Therapy is security writ large.
But, you know, Youngberg was considering a policy of physically restraining dangerous patients, and I'm not sure this court gets to override Youngberg if we have indeed said what you say we've said. I don't think we have.
Well, I don't think that the decisions override Youngberg, because Youngberg itself recognizes that security is a critical component of therapy. There's a third way for the... I see that I'm into my rebuttal, my colleague's time, so I'll just wrap up quickly. Under whether or not professional judgment applies, the plaintiffs haven't identified a constitutional right that was violated. So even if there is some sort of therapeutic component here, they haven't shown exactly what constitutional violation occurred. They haven't shown that, for instance, that they suffered an atypical significant deprivation. Their claim is very analogous to a prisoner in segregation. They're claiming that they don't have enough interaction.
Well, they're being deprived of... They're not prisoners. They're civil detainees.
Civil detainees.
They're being deprived of rehabilitation and treatment.
Yes. On the intermail claim, they're asking for a right that doesn't exist in the wider world, and we stand on our briefs on the Turner analysis.
I'll give you 2 minutes, counsel.
That's fine. Thank you. I just have a couple quick comments. Brad Elward for Dr. Jumper. The one thing that I guess the two things that I wanted to try and leave the court with it, it's our impression when we read the record, and this addresses some of your questions, Your Honor, that there were therapeutic concerns, perhaps not made by Dr. Jumper individually, but made by his clinical staff that went into the unit, the housing selections. And I think the testimony will show from Dr. Jumper and through his affidavit that we've really got multiple levels. And if I may walk through this very quickly, I think this whole...
And he's just here for injunctive relief, too, right? Nobody's
absolutely
talking about money.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My point was this. We have therapeutic decisions from the clinical segment being interjected into the housing or individual room, the pod, the unit, and the testimony is clear that that blueprint, that framework, was then taken and used to establish the interaction between the various units. In other words, what units are allowed, can Alpha interact with the Fox unit. And so from this, when we look at that statement on page 10 of the decision of the district court, where opposing counsel has kind of chastised us for saying, well, how can Dr. Jumper say he didn't have any involvement and then claim he did? But I think that sentence, and I'll read it to the court quickly, it says, even if the decision on unit interaction did require the exercise of professional clinical judgment, seems to the court that Dr. Jumper did exercise a judgment by not intervening. I think the answer to that and what that means is the next sentence. Dr. Jumper, in his professional judgment, decided it was an issue for security and not the therapist. When we look at his deposition at page 65, he clearly testified that I believe security decisions, issues override clinical concerns. And he says that treatment must have a safe environment in order to be effective. You can't have a therapeutic conducive environment without security. He says that at page 69 of his deposition. That supports the district court's findings, and that meshes with McAdory's comment that he's seen fewer incidents of aggression among the residents that were being treated than they did before this unit setup was implemented in August of 2010. So I think that is where the district court got that decision and that finding. Thank you.
Counsel, how much time? We'll give you 2 additional minutes as I did the other side. So you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I'd just like to make one brief point regarding the written communication policy, Judge Wood. You had the opening question that you put towards my colleague was whether there is a pre-existing internal mail system or whether one needs to be created. There is a pre-existing internal mail system. It allows for everyone at the facility, except for residents to residents, to send communication to each other.
So that's what I was trying to say. We don't have a situation right now where the residents have some limited use of it. It's more a staff or resident-to-staff system?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. Also,
would your arguments also apply to internal telephone calls? I assume there's an internal telephone system.
It could. We put that evidence in the record merely to demonstrate that there was no alternative means of them to communicate, to highlight the fact that the mail system is the only way that they have to communicate. I could see a case where perhaps if they could not show a legitimate reason to prohibit communication between units, where that might be a constitutional claim.
That's our next case.
However, I don't think it is, Your Honor, for this reason. Mail, by its very nature, is subject to being reviewed before it's delivered by security staff. Telephone calls are not that way. So they do. I think there is a tighter fit with security concerns with respect to telephone calls. As we lay out, I believe on page 36 of our opening brief, Your Honor, the facility could convert its U.S. mail system to an internal mail system simply by eliminating the steps that involve the Postal Service. The mail goes to a mail room, and then it's handed to the postal worker. It comes back to the same mail room and is delivered. All we are asking is that they simply take the mail to the mailroom and deliver it directly without going through the Postal Service. It requires no additional steps whatsoever. So I do think
but
we're talking
but
about
on elasticity of demand, considerations. If you have to pay 44 cents for a letter, you're not going to send as many of them as if they're free.
That's true, Your Honor, but I think that there's no record evidence to support that the volume would be so. We're not suggesting that it won't. The volume won't increase. It clearly will. But there's no evidence to suggest that it will increase to the point where it will burden resources. And if it did burden resources at that point, the facility could reevaluate the policy. But they're doing it before the fact without having any factual basis to go on. And if I may,
if an inmate has a complaint, it goes into that internal system, doesn't it, to get to the director, what have you?
I think that that's correct, Your Honor. Though
so they don't take inmate complaints through that.
They take inmate complaints to inmate communication to everyone except for another resident.
Would you also agree to have them examine the contents of them of the message?
I think that if in the exercise of the professional judgment of the facility staff, they deemed that to be an appropriate way to balance the security concerns with clinical concerns, that that would be an appropriate means, yes, Your Honor. I think that that's for – may I complete my answer, Your Honor? I think that's for the facility officials to determine the basis of their professional judgment, which to date we have not had. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel.